Greetings to all of you, brethren. As was mentioned, we definitely want to keep praying for the Osbornes. I don't have any further update besides the one that he was mentioning, but I didn't bring it with me. But know that that's just an ongoing trial, and certainly they need God's intervention, as many people do today in God's church, and as we wait for the end of this age when all these things will be resolved at last. We look forward to that wonderful, wonderful day that lies ahead. Until then, we have a lot of grief, suffering in this world. And we know that our enemy is out to destroy us all. There is malevolence directed at us very powerfully to trip us up and get us to go off course and get us to reject God and turn on Him and come to ruin. He and his minions would have us eliminated. And that's been the case for God's people throughout history, not just those of us in the church, but of course the spiritual nation of Israel and the Jewish people. This has been, they've been a target of terrible directed malevolence for thousands of years. This has been ongoing. A few years ago, actually, I think it was 2011, so this is now 2015, so it's been about 4 years, I went through a brief overview of the book of Esther and Purim, and although it wasn't that brief, I think I ran over on a sermon that time. But I want to revisit that now, because this coming week will be Purim. I think it's on, it's the 4th and 5th, I'm not sure what evening it starts. I know in the Hebrew calendar it would be the 14th and the 15th. The day of the fast of Esther on the 13th is the way the Jewish people keep that. And of the last month of the Hebrew year. And as I've mentioned before, you have always Purim comes a month before Passover. And it's just a very interesting thing. Even when you have the 13th month, Purim is basically observed in that 13th month, which is considered the 12th month. It's just that they stuck an extra 12th month in before it. And sometimes they have what's called a Purim Katan in the 12th month, and Purim Gadol, that is little Purim and great Purim. The great Purim is always in the last month. It's either in the 12th month, if there's only 12 months in a year. If there's 13, it's in the 13th month. That's how they observe that. And I won't begrudge them that, because, again, I mean, the Bible does mention Purim, that it's, you know, something that the Jewish people were to keep at a certain time. But it's not a commandment in the law, the way the various festivals and holy days that God directly gave are mentioned. This was something that the Jews bound upon themselves. But it's something worthwhile, and it's something worthy to be reminded of. It's in the Bible. It's in the Old Testament. It is not something that we have nothing to do with. It has a lot to do with us being here today. As I mentioned before, we wouldn't be here today if it was not for what happened in those days at that time. This is very important to always remember that. Well, I'd like to start out by reading something that this was written. I have a few things that I found on the internet that I thought were worthwhile to mention. This is from Mark Stover, who writes for Jews for Jesus. He said, Purim is classified as one of the minor holidays, yet that is not the assessment of the ancient rabbis. Many believed the book of Esther was intended to illustrate that God is at work behind the scenes. Which is, you know, interesting, because the book of Esther does not actually mention God by name directly. There may be, it may be hidden in there as well, but it's not directly stated in there the way it is in other biblical books. But many believe the book of Esther was, again, intended to illustrate God's work behind the scenes. That interpretation makes sense in light of a biblical text that neglects to mention the name of God, the concept of religion, even the ritual of prayer. Although it does mention fasting. I mean, you'd expect that. You don't just go without food for no reason. I mean, that obviously was to accompany prayer. More than one sage compared Purim to the major holiday of Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. The Hasidim, that is the very pious ones, interpreted Purim as a classic case of Kiddush Hashem, the sanctification of the name, where individual Jews were willing to die rather than forsake their faith. And indeed, that was true. Part of the reason they were singled out is because they were different in their practice. That's directly mentioned in the book. More than one sage compared it, the preservation of the Jewish people under severe hardship and genocidal threats is a theme woven throughout our history. At Purim, Haman is a metaphor of evil, like Pharaoh or Antiochus Epiphanes, or others who conducted the pogroms, even Adolf Hitler. In a speech in 1944, Hitler said that if the Nazis were defeated, the Jewish people could celebrate a second triumphant Purim. And that's quite an acknowledgement, quite a remarkable acknowledgement, that basically he saw himself in the role of Haman and reveled in that. He did not expect that the Jews would be celebrating a second triumphant Purim. He expected to have the final solution be rid of them forever as he established his thousand-year Reich as the rightful Messiah. It's outrageous. Well, it's interesting we look at this book. I'd like you to turn to the book of Esther and go through a number of points here. First of all, one thing I want to mention is Esther itself is a sort of a strange name because it's the name of this woman who is the main character in the story. But it's not the name she went by among her people. The name she went by was Hadassah. And that's mentioned here too, that her actual name was Hadassah. But Hadassah just means a myrtle, so a myrtle tree. And it's a beautiful tree. One of the tree leaves that were used in tabernacles, actually. But that's not what Esther means. It might, actually. There is a tie-in. But Esther is probably a name that comes from Ishtar, the pagan goddess of Babylon, after which we get the name Easter today. So it's interesting, there's this strange tie-in to that. And we wonder, why would that be? And it's probably true that Mordecai, her cousin who raised her, his name probably is derived from Marduk, the Babylonian pagan, you know, god as well. I mean, these are pagan names. And it probably has to do, we see there's an attempt, you know, where he tells her to keep her Jewish identity secret. And it was very common practice among the Jews that they would have a name they were known among their own people, but then among the Gentiles, they would take a Gentile name and kind of blend in. So a lot of times, they it would avoid being singled out for persecution. That was one way to affect that, is that they would have these dealings as if they were part of that society. There may be more involved, too. I don't know when they got these names, because we cannot trust the way that this is written. I don't want to say we can't trust the Bible, but what I mean is the way this is written, when was she known as Esther? Was she known as that growing up? Or was it even later, after she, you know, when she got into the office of the queen or became part of the harem, that she started going by that name? Same with Mordecai. I mean, he's called that in the story, but we don't know when he actually took on that name. Actually, we know no other name for him, but I suspect he had a Hebrew name, and that was probably not when he, you know, what he went by. But it's my personal belief about this story, and I'll just mention another reason why this is, that this was probably originally written as a state chronicle, a Persian state chronicle, and so that you did not have them, you know, you would have them called by these other names from the very get-go of the story, and you would be identifying them that way, even if they were not called by that name yet. It's a matter of you see this a lot of times in the Bible, by the way, where certain names of places are used that weren't called that place yet at the time that the place was mentioned. Find that later it was given that name. But it was called that because people would know what place you were talking about. Same with people here. You've got that issue going on as well. But it is kind of strange and troubling to us that you would have these two characters hiding behind the names of pagan gods if that's what was going on. And I don't want to presume that's exactly what was going on, because if you would think about it, a lot of the names that are used in society today are by people come from pagan gods. Somebody might be called Diana, and we'd think nothing of calling them Diana, and they wouldn't think about the fact that they were bearing the name of a pagan god. So there would just be no thought given to that at all. And that may be the case with the way these names were used at that time. We don't know enough about the way that the names were used at that time. But certainly this was a society that did worship these pagan deities, although these were from Babylon and now they were in Persia, and the Persians had taken over, and they would not necessarily have directly worshiped them as the Persians. They would have just incorporated them from taking over from the Babylonians. Now you have another possibility, though, and that is there is the word sitar, and that is in Hebrew, and it's very close to the way Esther's name is presented here, and that word means hidden. That is actually a word in Hebrew that means hidden, so that her name may have borne that meaning of hidden as a, and it may have served dual purpose. Maybe it was Ishtar as to get along in that society, but it was a clue to her Jewish identity as well as the meaning of this book, that it is talking about something that's hidden here. What's hidden? Well, we know that God's name is not mentioned here, but definitely God is hidden in this story all through it. Maybe not even so much hidden. It's just the name is hidden, but his activities are clearly seen. There's the word stara, which is the Persian word for star. But, of course, that comes from the same root as Ishtar. Ishtar is the name where you get this sense of a star. So it probably has the same derivation there. In fact, Ishtar was identified with the star Venus, which was really a planet. But, I mean, they called it a star. And that had an association there. And there's also a possibility that it's related to astra, which is the Median word I found out for myrtle. And that could be a tie-in too. So we don't know exactly. I don't want to, say we definitely know the answer to that. But the fact that Mordecai has a name like Marduk as well seems to support the idea that that these were related terms. Well, here in chapter 1, we have the story of the deposition or dethronement of Queen Vashti, and who was married to King Ahasuerus, as mentions here. Ahasuerus is what we have in our English Bibles. Actually, in the Hebrew, it's Achshuash, and you think that's really weird. But we know this is the Greek Xerxes, X-E-R-X-E-S, and we say, how do you get from Xerxes to Ahasuerus? How is this the same? It actually is the same name because the Hebrew, as I mentioned, is Achshuash. The actual Persian form of the Greek Xerxes is Kishiarsha. And so you've got Kishiarsha becomes Akushuarsha, becomes Ahasuerus or Ahasuerus. It's a really weird way that we move between those. But it's not so strangely different as it seems. There is definitely a relation between these names. And what you see in this account is he wanted to parade Queen Vashti before these other people at these great banquets that he had, and she did not deign to come out and take part in that. And it may have been wise. I mean, we don't know what was all going on there. I don't want to say that she was the problem in that. My guess is she wasn't. I think there was a lot of bad going on here with these rulers. And then he was very angry about what happened, and his nobles told him, hey, you need to do something about her because we don't want our wives being able to not do what we say. And so he ordered that she be deposed and, took the suggestion that he find somebody new. And by the way, he was very impetuous, evidently. He had quite a temper on him, Xerxes did. This is something I found also on the internet about what Herodotus said about him. Herodotus, the famous Greek historian, clearly no fan of a king that invaded his country. He reported on this bad temper. And here are two stories from the king's history. This is about the failed bridge across the Hellespont. That he says, they then began to build bridges across the Hellespont from Abydos to that headland between Cestus and Matitus, the Phoenicians building one of ropes made from flax, and the Egyptians building a second one out of papyrus, from Abydos to the opposite shore. And by the way, this was all part of his empire. He had a huge empire at that time. From Abydos to the opposite shore is a distance of almost two-thirds of a mile, but no sooner had the strait been bridged than a great storm came on and cut apart and scattered all their work. Xerxes flew into a rage at this, and he commanded that the Hellespont be struck with 300 strokes of the whip, the water we're talking about, and that a pair of foot chains be thrown into the sea. It's even been said that he sent off a rank of branders along with the rest to the Hellespont. He also commanded the scourgers to speak outlandish and arrogant words. You hateful water, our master lays his judgment on you thus, for you have unjustly punished him even though he's done you no wrong. Xerxes the king will pass over you, whether you wish it or not. It is fitting that no man offer you sacrifices, for you're a muddy and salty river. In these ways he commanded that the sea be punished, and also that the heads be severed from all those who directed the bridging of the Hellespont. So this is quite a character. Here's another story about him, a father's request. As he marched out the army, Pythias the Lydian, dreading the heavenly omen and encouraged by the gifts given to him by Xerxes, came up to Xerxes and said, Master, I wish to ask a favor of you, which would be a small favor for you to render, but would be a great favor to me to receive. Xerxes, thinking he knew everything Pythias could ask for, answered that he would grant the favor and asked him to proclaim what it was he wished. You know, I think of him when he said to Esther, you know, what do you wish? I'll give it to you up to half my kingdom. You know, this is kind of what he was saying to this guy here. Master, it happens that I have five sons, and they're all bound to soldier for you against the Greeks. I pray you, king, that you have pity on one who has reached my age, and that you set free one of my sons, even the oldest, from your army, so that he may provide for me and my possessions. Take the other four with you, and may you return, having accomplished all you intended. Well, this does not sit very well. Xerxes flew into a horrible rage and replied, You villainous man! You have the effrontery, seeing me marching with my army against the Greeks, with my sons and brothers and relatives and friends, to remind me of your son, you, my slave, who should rather come with me with your entire household, including your wife. You may now be certain of this, that since the spirit lives in man's ears, hearing good words, it fills the body with delight. When it hears the opposite, it swells up. When you at one time performed well and promised more, you had no reason to boast that you outperformed your king in benefits. And now that you have turned most shameless, you should receive less than what you deserve. You and four of your sons are saved because of your hospitality. But one of your sons, the one you most desire to hold your arms around, will lose his life. Having answered thus, he commanded those charged to accomplish this and to find the eldest of Pythias' sons and cut him in half. And having cut him in two, to set one half of his corpse on the right side of the road and the other on the left side. And between these, the armies moved forth. So, good to remember what kind of person he was, you know, as we think about what they were having to deal with in this story. And we have here in chapter 2 the story about Esther becoming the queen. They started out with a beauty pageant, you know, and then she basically, and to find all the, you know, the young, beautiful virgins we sought for, and they went and gathered them all out of the realm. This was quite a lot of people, and they prepared them, you know, basically for a year. She became part of the harem, and then they were to go in with the king. And, of course, the idea was, how is he going to remember one? I mean, he's got different ones for every night. It's kind of like Solomon in a way, but it's just, just bring them all in. And this massive harem here. And some, you know, people have some kind of romantic notions about this, but it was not like that at all. It was just absolutely awful. Definitely not a good circumstance. But it certainly was not by choice. Eventually, though, she became the queen. And it was, you know, through this process, it's just absolutely amazing that she became the queen. And it's setting up this whole story of all the things that happened. But again, we might think how amazing this was, that verse 18, then the king made a great feast, the feast of Esther, for all his officials and servants, and he proclaimed a holiday in the provinces and gave gifts according to the generosity of the king. You think, well, how great is that? Here she is the king now, or she's the queen now, sorry. But Here's something that I never noticed before. I don't know how I read over this before. Maybe you've noticed this. But it says in verse 19, when virgins were gathered together a second time, Mordecai sat within the king's gate. Do you see that? That wasn't over. Here you had another time. They're bringing him in, and she's already the queen. So I find that very interesting. Here was this king who was still doing this and having these brought in. Because we a lot of times get the idea was he went through all these ones, then he found this one he prized, Esther, and then she was just the prize from then on. And it was not any of these others. But, of course, here he still has, you know, more coming in to, you know, worked well the first time, I guess. Let's just keep it going. Something else about this I found very interesting. This was written by Donald Curtis in Creation to the Cross. I found this on the internet. And I thought he makes some very interesting observations. One, he mentions paired events. It says, nearly every event in Esther happens twice. The second time being a variation of the first. In the first chapter, there's a long banquet and a short banquet. In the second chapter, there is a virgin pageant that leads to the queening of Esther, followed by a second virgin pageant. Esther holds two banquets later that lead to the downfall of Haman, which is paired with the two banquets that led to the fall of Vashti. There is a decree that zips through the empire calling for the destruction of the Jews, and then there is a later decree sent calling for the destruction of their enemies. Esther comes twice unannounced to King Ahasuerus. We'll see that a little bit later. Haman goes home with his head covered after giving honor to Mordecai, and his head is covered before he's hung. The Jewish defense in Susa lasts for an extra day. Paired events are one of the motifs of this book, and I just think that's very interesting too. How this story is set up. There are also ironic reversals he mentions here, which I think the whole thing we could see is clearly an ironic reversal, what happens here, but there's a number of things that are mentioned here. Related to the paired events are a series of ironic reversals in Esther. Ahasuerus commands Vashti to come before him. She refuses, loses her position. Esther comes before him uncommanded at the peril of her life, but gains position. Esther comes before him, let's skip ahead here. In chapter 1, a decree is sent to the empire that wives are to obey their husbands. But at the end of Esther, it shows her to be obeyed. Mordecai, a Jew, refuses to bow to Haman, and later Haman bows before Esther, a Jew. Haman is lifted up by Ahasuerus and then humbled. The Jews fast, and then the Jews feast. There is the casting of lots to choose a day, and providential events foil the day. As with the paired events, the ironic reversals come into play with places where there is seemingly some mention of the Lord in this story hidden in the text, which we'll mention a little bit later. So here we go, if we're looking here at chapter 2. Let's look here in verses 21 through 23. It says, in those days when Mordecai sat within the king's gate, and now we don't know when Mordecai acquired this position. It's very likely he acquired it through, with some help from Esther. But maybe he already had a position. We don't really know exactly how he got this position. But he was evidently had some position within the government. That's what we're talking about here, sitting within the gates, within the king's gate. Two of the king's eunuchs, Bigthan and Teresh, doorkeepers, became furious and sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. So the matter became known to Mordecai, who told Queen Esther, and Esther informed the king in Mordecai's name. And when an inquiry was made into the matter, it was confirmed, and both were hanged on a gallows. And it was written in the book of the Chronicles in the presence of the king. A few things to mention here. First of all, Mordecai saves the king from a plot here. Basically, there was going to be an attempt on his life, and Mordecai saved him. And as we're going to find out later, nothing was done for Mordecai when this happened, which is a very unusual thing. Because normally the kings of Persia prided themselves on rewarding loyalty. That was not done in this case. And you think, why was that not done? It was not done because it sets up what happens later in the story. And you think, well, who set it up? Certainly not the king himself. Certainly not any of these people here. This was set up by someone else, that this would happen, that he would not do what was the normal expectation to do in rewarding Mordecai for revealing this plot. Also, it mentions that both were hanged on a gallows. And the gallows here is not what we think of as this big scaffolding with the ropes hanging to hide the noose around. Basically, this is either just, it may be a structure, but really we're talking about big poles that are stuck up so people can be skewered or impaled, basically, or crucified, essentially, displayed in penal suspension so that everybody would look to them and see, these guys did bad. I mean, that's what hanging was to be later, but of course you'd hang people when they were still alive and they would drop dead. That's not usually the way this would work with impalement. I mean, I guess they might die by being impaled, or they could actually be killed and then already their bodies set on impalement. We see this a little bit later in the story because it mentions hanging Haman's sons, but they're already dead. So it's really talking about just putting their bodies up on display, and that's what this is talking about too. And I mentioned that here. I know it's gruesome, but it actually has a big part of the story later with Mordecai and Haman. And then we see something comes to be after this. Chapter 3, it says, after these things, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, and advanced him and set his seat above the princes who were with him. And all the king's servants who were within the king's gate bowed and paid homage to Haman, for so the king had commanded concerning him, but Mordecai would not bow or pay homage. Now, it's interesting, this name Haman, because we actually see this still today in Persia. Persia is Iran. And this name Haman is essentially the same name as the supreme ruler of Iran today, the Ayatollah Khomeini. Khomeini is Haman. essentially the same name. It's it comes to us in English in a little bit different form. But really, we're talking about the same name among the same people. Except that he was not necessarily native Persian. He had a different background. It says that he was an Agagite. Now, that seems to refer to a part of the Persian Empire. But this seems to be a part of the Persian Empire where certain of the Edomites migrated to. And not going into all the details of this, but this he's referred to as an Agagite, and that probably has to do with being a descendant of Agag. Agag was a character in the Bible at the time of Saul. He was the king of the Amalekites, and Samuel had told him from God that Saul was supposed to destroy all of the Amalekites, including the king, but he spared the king, and he spared a lot of others among the Amalekites as well. Should not have done that because God had given direct orders, and it goes way back. By the way, God had at the time of the Exodus given this. I'll just reference for you Exodus 17 and verse 6, because remember when the Israelites came out of Egypt, they were attacked by the Amalekites. And they had to fight against the Amalekites. And this was an underhanded blow. And God says in Exodus 17:6, he says, write this scroll as something to be remembered and make sure that Joshua hears it, because I will completely blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven. I will be at war with the Amalekites from generation to generation. So they were to be blotted out, these people. And in Deuteronomy 25, this is verses 17 and 19, Deuteronomy 25. We see this again. Remember what the Amalekites did to you along the way when you came out of Egypt. When the Lord your God gives you rest from all the enemies around you and the land he has given you to possess as an inheritance, you shall blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven. Do not forget, God said. But it didn't get done. Saul did not do the job he was supposed to do there. And so it's interesting because because as you look at this account, it says Mordecai would not bow or pay homage, verse 2. The Jews would pay homage to people. They would bow to people, but he would not bow to this man. And it says, then the king's servants who were within the king's gate said to Mordecai, why do you transgress the king's command? Now it happened when they spoke to him daily that he would not listen to them, that they told it to Haman, to see whether Mordecai's words would stand, for Mordecai had told them that he was a Jew. That's interesting. He told Esther not to tell people that she was a Jew. But when they said, why won't you bow to this man? He said, because I'm a Jew, and I will not do that. Which is very strange, though. Again, it's a puzzle here because the Jews would bow to people. Certainly they bowed to the king. They bowed to others, but they would not bow. He would not bow to this man. And it's probably because, as Josephus also says, by the way, that this man was an Agagite, a descendant of King Agag of the Amalekites. And it may be a little bit more here because we, in learning about Mordecai, it mentions earlier in chapter 2, it says in verse 5, in Shushan, in the citadel, there was a certain Jew whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite. Which is a very interesting heritage. Because Kish, of course, this is a different Kish, I'm sure, but Kish was the father, if you recall, of Saul. And Saul and one of Saul's household was Shimei, who later resisted David. And this is people named in this heritage who seem to be perpetuating that heritage of King Saul. We see it all the way in the New Testament. You've got Saul, a Benjamite, in the New Testament, who is probably of the lineage of that lineage, or at least of the tribe of Benjamin. And Saul was a big deal to that tribe because he was a king that came from that tribe. And so you have here this heritage from Benjamin that is in Mordecai, and he may even be a descendant of Saul, but he certainly is a descendant of Benjamin through who were the people that were supposed to be killing the Agagites at that time. They didn't do it. And I think it's interesting that we see this this sort of family heritage coming down between both sides of this. Now, Haman reacts to this very interestingly because Haman could have said, well, the king ordered it. This guy's not bowing. You know, he gets killed. That's the punishment. But that's not the punishment that Haman sought. Haman, it says, because he said he was in verse 5, when Haman saw that Mordecai did not bow or pay him homage, Haman was filled with wrath, but he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone, for they had told him of the people of Mordecai. Instead, Haman sought to destroy all the Jews who were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus, the people of Mordecai. That's a lot of Jews. In fact, it's over a huge area. I mean, it's all the way stretched from Greece over to India. Basically, we're talking about a lot of Jewish people and the ones that were in the Holy Land as well. This is a lot of Jews that he wanted to kill them all. He's very much a type of our enemy, by the way. I mentioned to you there is an enemy who wants to kill us. He wants to see us all dead too. And they're much in common because this is his mindset expressed here through this man. But certainly this seems to lend to this idea that there is a heritage of feuding going on here between these peoples. And that's why he wanted to kill them. But of course he also gives the reason for it. When he tries to convince the king, verse 8, then Haman said to King Ahasuerus, there's a certain people scattered and dispersed among the people in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from all other peoples, and they do not keep the king's laws. Therefore, it is not fitting for the king to let them remain. They should not live. If it please the king, let a decree be written that they be destroyed, and I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands. This is millions of dollars, by the way. It's apparently he was a wealthy person to do the work to bring it into the king's treasuries. A lot of money. Sounds good. And we can, and also because they'd be able to pillage these peoples and take all that belonged to them. And that would pay for itself. That's how we could do the job. But here's part of the problem with this. I mean, the king went along with this. Now, we know how kind of impetuous he was, and he did crazy things. But later, you know, he's going to honor, we find out, Mordecai the Jew. Did he know it was the Jews that were being killed? Remember later, I mean, we don't really know, because it doesn't exactly say. You think, how could you not know that? But, of course, Haman was his prime minister, and he just kind of was giving a lot of trust over to him. And again, let's recall that these events are being orchestrated from on high. And there may be a lot that was hidden from the king to make this whole scenario work out. It may be that he wouldn't have had the Jews killed if he knew that's who it was, but maybe he would have. We really don't know. He certainly wasn't a good guy, this king. He was a bad guy. But, you know, maybe there were some okay things about him. He was a typical, you know, ruler of that age. And there's bad things to say about that. Probably there's some good things to say too, but a lot of bad. Now, we see here going on in the account something very interesting. It says in verse 7, in the first month, which is the month of Nisan, and this is a very important timing, it's the first month in the Hebrew calendar, in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus, which, by the way, if you look at the time of this, this is the 12th year from when it was before. I think it was in the 7th when that plot had been discovered. Now, it's basically 5 years later from when that plot had been discovered. And I don't want to say that positively because I don't see it right now. Well, yeah, verse 16, that King Ahasuerus in his royal palace in the 10th month would reign of Tebeth in the 7th year of his reign. So that's a long time that, again, since Mordecai had saved the king's life. But it says here in verse 7 of chapter 3, in the first month, which is the month of Nisan, the 12th year of King Ahasuerus, they cast Pur, that is the lot. Pur is an Akkadian word. That is the lot, before Haman to determine the day and month until it fell on the 12th month, which is the month of Adar. Well, I don't think this is exactly translated right in the New King James. The King James Version says this, that the lot was cast before Haman from day to day and from month to month until it fell on the 12th month in the month of Adar. But think about that for a second. They were casting the lot, it says, from month to month, from day to day and month to month. That doesn't mean they were casting it all along until that just happened. I think because they knew in advance when it was going to be, because they sent a decree out right after this saying that's when the decree would be. So what does this mean? Here is what I think this means. I don't think it's definitive enough here in the New King James. I think the King James is better. That what they were doing was they were casting a lot for each day of the year, like starting from when they were at, you know, here in Nisan, they cast a lot for this day. Nope. For the next date, 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 no. And they're in the first month, and it did not land until the 12th month. Think about that for a second. That is a miracle. That this thing did not. If you think of, you think about it like a coin, you're flipping. You know, you're trying to land on heads, and you keep getting tails, 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 tails. Every day or every month, you go through 11 months. You're down to the last month. Finally, heads. Well, this would surely seem very miraculous, even to Haman. I mean, he might have been getting discouraged at first, I might think. He might think, this is never going to come up heads. It's going to be tails. And when is it going to come up heads? It seemed like, you know, supernatural that it was not coming up heads. And then finally, it comes up heads, and it's way at the end of the year. So he must have thought, aha, this is clearly what the gods have ordained. Well, the God that we know did ordain that as the day that the decree would be set for. But it gave such an advantage to the Jews, as it ends up in the story, because even though they were in a world in a heap of trouble right now, this thing being set almost a year away would be of an immense help to them. And so that's how the lot fell. And it's just an amazing fact. And then also let's notice this about the decree. I want you to note this for later. It says, then verse 12, then the king's scribes were called on the 13th day of the first month, and a decree was written according to all that Haman commanded to the king, to the king's satraps, etc. And it says, to every province according to the script, to every people in their language, in the name of King Ahasuerus it was written and sealed with the king's signet ring. I think I'm missing the thing I'm looking for here. Verse 13, that's what I'm looking for, sorry. And the letters were sent by courtiers into all the king's provinces. Notice these words, and these words will be seen later, which is why I wanted to draw them to your attention. To destroy, to kill, to annihilate all the Jews, both young and old, little children and women, in one day, on the 13th month of Adar, or 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, and to plunder their possessions. And a copy of the document was to be issued. That specific wording is evidently the wording of the document itself. It's part of the wording of the document itself, because we'll see these words repeated in a new document, which some people think the Jews were horrible in the wording that we later see. But really what it is they're just quoting these words that were from the original document. We'll see this again. Notice how it says, to destroy, to kill, to annihilate all the Jews, both young and old, little children and women, in one day, on the 13th day of the 12th month, was in the month of Adar, and to plunder their possessions. So that is the ruling that was given in this decree. And then this is kind of an awful situation that the Jews are now in. What is going to happen? Well, we see in chapter 4 that says when Mordecai learned of all that had happened, went out to the midst of the city and cried with a loud and bitter cry. Well, let's remember when this was. This was done on... This was done at the very time of Passover, by the way, is when this whole situation happens. It was actually the 13th was the date of this decree. It says that that it was the 13th day of the first month. But now when did Mordecai learn of this decree? It could have been that day. But what's interesting is this. Let's think about this timing. That if they found out about this on the 13th, or if this is when the decree went out, was on the 13th day of the first month, that means that evening was the Passover. That very evening would be the Passover. Now, how were the Jews observing the Passover then? We don't really know, because they weren't in the Holy Land, so they weren't probably doing animal sacrifice. They weren't doing lamb sacrifices or anything like that. But certainly, I'm sure they had some kind of a commemoration of these, of recalling the Passover at this time. That would have been that evening when that would have occurred. And then he brings this whole case to the queen. And then what does she say? It says he gave her a copy of the written decree in verse 8 of chapter 4. And then there's sort of a back and forth where they're sending people back and forth trying to communicate between each other. And then he explains what's going to happen, that they're going to kill Saul, basically, who've been sold out. But she says in verse 11, yet I myself have not been called to go into the king these 30 days. Now, I find this very interesting, too, because what that means is that if this is right at Passover time, and she's saying she hasn't been into the king for 30 days, which shows a sign of disfavor, it means that 30 days is the month leading up to Passover, which later ends up being, by the way, the very month that I was talking about, how Purim always is exactly a month before Passover. So that 30 days is the same 30 days as between Purim and Passover, although at this time there was yet no Purim. But I just find that an interesting parallel of things going on here. And then, there's a lot of parallels here, because he gives her the famous line in verses 13 and 14, Mordecai told them to answer Esther, because she is worried. You know, she said in the previous chapter, verse 11, that all will be put to death except the one to whom the king holds out the golden scepter. If she comes in unannounced, she could be killed. And we know how very impetuous he was, a dangerous person. It would be very likely that she could be killed. But that isn't what is going to happen. But what's interesting here is, but it was a real fear. I just wanted to show you. This wasn't like some crazy worry that she had. Because when people think, well, she was the queen. And she really, if he liked her so much, she wasn't in any real danger. She was in very real danger, at least in her mind. Even though really she wasn't. Because there was somebody else who was running the show. And so, it says in verse 13, Mordecai told him to answer Esther, do not think in your heart that you will escape in the king's palace any more than all the other Jews. For if you remain completely silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place. But you and your father's house will perish. Yet who knows whether you've come to the kingdom for such a time as this. This may be why you're here. And it was, brethren. This is why you maybe have been put here in this position to be able to deal with this situation. Then Esther told them to reply to Mordecai, go gather all the Jews who are present in Shushan and fast for me, and neither eat nor drink for 3 days, night or day. My maids and I will fast likewise, and so I will go to the king, which is against the law. And if I perish, I perish. So this is very interesting on so many levels. First of all, we see this statement again, for such a time as this. You know, brethren, this applies to all of us in whatever circumstance we find ourselves. Who knows whether you've been brought here to God's church and among his people and in this nation, whatever it might be, for such a time as this. This is maybe the very time you're called on to do whatever it is you need to do. And our duty is always to listen to whatever God tells us and to do that. But then very interesting here as well is this 3-day fast, night and day, 3 days and three nights of fasting. Now, it seems to me, again, that they found out about this, or at least Mordecai did, on the 13th in the daytime. And maybe then that evening, you would have been having the Passover remembrance. And then, I don't know how long this back and forth went, but she had to declare this fast that would have to get out to everybody to tell them to do this 3-day fast. And it seems likely that that would have started the next night. At least to me it does. Which means, if that's true, that the 3 days and three nights of this fast would be the exact same 3 days and three nights that Jesus Christ was dead. And what is also interesting about this is that she presented herself as a sacrifice. She was essentially as good as dead for these 3 days and three nights. Coming to the king, there was an expectation she could die. But then he held out the scepter and she was accepted and lived. And that is at the end of 3 days and three nights. I find it, this is no coincidence, absolutely no coincidence that this is here. And it's just, we think about this as an unrelated thing, and we see now, we should see, this is directly related to Passover and unleavened bread. This is the very time this happened. It was the Passover and unleavened bread. This is exactly when this story is occurring. And it is an exact parallel. And I also find it interesting, you remember the story about Abraham when he was taken to sacrifice Isaac, his son. And it says he went there, you know, and the Lord will provide a lamb and all that. Mary says he and on the third day, it says, that's when they were there. So for those 3 days, since he had been given the command to go, Isaac was as good as dead. And it's actually mentioned in Hebrews 11:19. That was in Genesis 22, but in Hebrews 11:19, it says that Abraham did receive Isaac from the dead in a figurative sense, because he was as good as dead. He was reckoned as dead. And Abraham was going to slay him until God spared him on that third day and said he did not have to die. And same with Esther. Essentially, she said, if I perish, I perish. I think about it a little bit the way that Jesus prayed. You know, if there's any other way, let this cup be taken from me. Nevertheless, not my will, but your will be done. But in his case, he did not have a reprieve. He had to go through and pay the full penalty. He had to be the sacrifice for all of us. And it is there's so much in here that is just truly mind-boggling. Well, the source that I was earlier quoting says that the reason that Mordecai does not appeal to God here, and that there's no mention here of Passover, even though that would have been at this time, is because Mordecai and Esther were not religious. Well, that to me is nonsense, because you know, he firmly believes that deliverance will come from somewhere no matter what. And she declares a 3-day fast. For what? If she has no religious sensibilities, this doesn't make any sense. She's saying, fast, you all fast for me. Why is she asking that? Because this is clearly an appeal to the Creator God. There's no other explanation for what's going on here. And again, it seems that this is more intentional that there's no mention of God, to show that he's hidden in the circumstances. We're not directly mentioning him on purpose. And also, I suspect, as I mentioned, that this was originally written as a Persian state chronicle, which would probably not directly promote the Jewish religion. That may be why it's not directly overtly stated and it's just hinted at as you go through. Don't know. But to say that they were not religious and, you know, had no religious sensibilities, that to me is absurd when we consider this. Now, what else do we have here? Chapter 5. We see her, Esther says, you know, because the king says, well, what do you want? She says, well, I want to have a banquet, you know, for you, basically. They go to the banquet, Haman and the king, very strange. But he says, what's going on? She says, well, I'd like you to come back for another banquet, which seems very strange. Again, maybe she just got uncertain. Maybe it just didn't seem right now. Maybe there's something that made her think, this isn't the time. I need to give it another day. I don't know. Maybe it was an uncertainty on her part. You think, well, she wasn't acting in faith because she was already delivered. She should have said, clearly she should not have acted at that point in time. We can't judge and say why she did what she did. We don't really know the answer. We just know that this set up something huge, because it was the very fact that she said to come back the next day that allowed that night was the night the king couldn't sleep. This is still the days of unleavened bread, by the way. These events are all in the days of unleavened bread, after a resurrection of sorts. It's very interesting. We look at these timing. Now, so it wasn't revealed at the first banquet. And then we find later here that Haman's plot against Mordecai. We find that at the end of chapter 5, in verse 14, it mentions that he set up a gallows, you know, for Mordecai, 50 cubits high, to hang Mordecai on. He's thinking he's on top of the world. The queen invited me to the banquet. Everything's so great. It's so wonderful. And now I'm going to get rid of my enemy and have him displayed for the whole world. Fantastic. That's what was being, you know, this gigantic irony is being set up. And this gigantic reversal is being set up by the master storyteller is what's happening here. Now, we see in chapter 6, the king gets no sleep. And again, I recommend that you read this next week. You know, when it comes up on Purim this week, read through the book of Esther again. Or, you know, there's ones you can watch. There's one I have that One Night with the King is a movie, by the way, that is, it's okay in that it's kind of cool because it kind of gives you the grandeur of Persia sense. But the story, I don't believe that. But there's another one that I have, which was a Bible movie that I can't remember who plays in it, but I think it's much better done. And we'll probably watch that this week, I think. Anyway, the king gets no sleep. Haman comes in the morning. The king, because it's right at the very time that the king said, hey, just start reading me the chronicles because I need to go to sleep. And this is going to put him to sleep, just reading some boring history. He wants to drift off to these chronicles being read to him. And as they're being read, he finds out, hey, there's Mordecai. Save the king. And he said, well, what was done for this man? Well, they looked, nothing. How's that possible? What are we going to do? And that's when Mordecai walks in early in the morning. And the king says, well, what should we do to the person we want to honor? And Haman comes in. And he says, what do we want to do for the person we want to honor? And Haman, you know, thinks, I'm on top of the world. This is all for me. I'm going to tell him what I would like to be done for me. Parade me through the city and proclaim how great I am. And so he sets it all up, and the king says, great, that's what you're going to do for Mordecai the Jew, his mortal enemy. This is absolutely incredible. Well, we see in verse, and so he does. He has to go out, you know, proclaiming these praises, parading him around. And then we see in chapter 6 and verse 12, it says that after Mordecai went back to the king's gate, but Haman hurried to his house mourning with his head covered. That was the first time his head is covered, by the way. And it's a foreshadowing of having his head covered in a worse way, not by his own choosing. Because notice, his head is covered, and right immediately, he says, when he told his wife Zeresh, verse 13, and all his friends, everything that had happened to him, his wise men and his wife Zeresh said to him, if Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of Jewish descent, you will not prevail against him, but will surely fall before him. The handwriting was on the wall, so to speak. They thought, this is looking really bad for you. Okay. So how's this going to come about? Because they're thinking the king is honoring Mordecai, and you have a big plot to kill all the Jews, and that would mean killing Mordecai, and this isn't going to go very well for you, is the way they're reasoning this, and they were certainly right. Chapter 7, we come to the second banquet. So we have the second banquet. And verse 7 is interesting. It says, then the king arose in his wrath. This is after she identifies Haman as the one who's going to get them all. It says, then the king arose in his wrath from the banquet of wine. Actually, I think it just says in the literal is he just arose from his anger from drinking wine. So is his anger from the wine? Because maybe he was a mean drunk. Some people say, and that this is, and maybe Esther knew that, and why it's good to get him a little bit drinking here when it's time to let him know what's going on. We don't really know exactly what was going on there, but certainly this was a big surprise to him, and he was flabbergasted and furious. And so he comes back in, and of course Haman is bowing there to Esther and pleading for his life. And it looks like he's trying to attack the queen. Verse 8, and the king says, will he also assault the queen while I'm in the house? As the word left the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face. So that was it for him. He was done for. And so we see that's was foreshadowed earlier. Then we come to chapter 8. Esther saves the Jews in this whole, but not immediately, because there's a few other interesting things here. Notice it says in verse 1 and 2, on that day King Ahasuerus gave Queen Esther the house of Haman, the enemy of the Jews, and Mordecai came before the king, for Esther had told her how he was related to her. So the king took off his signet ring, which he had taken from Haman, and gave it to Mordecai, and Esther appointed Mordecai over the house to Haman. You know, Esther was a type of the Messiah who gave her life basically in a sacrifice to save the people. But so was Mordecai. He was also, in that sense, a type of the Messiah. A lot of God's people through the Bible end up being a type of what Christ experienced. Mordecai, remember, he wept for his people. He humbled himself. He risked his life. And as a result of that, he triumphed over his enemies. And here he puts on royal robes and he's sit next to the king in power and authority. This is very much a messianic parallel. Just as Jesus humbled himself to death and is exalted to the right hand of the Father. Now we see in verses 3 through 8 that we have something more here. We've still got a problem. Because it says, Esther spoke again to the king and fell down at his feet and implored him with tears to counteract the evil of Haman the Agagite. In verse 4, and the king held out the golden scepter toward Esther. So Esther stood and arose before the king. This happened again. She goes back to the king, and he has to hold out the scepter to her again to be accepted. So, and again, she's sort of in peril here when she does this. Now, when was this? And so he ends up giving them the authority to write a decree to override the first one. Because in Persian law, you couldn't get rid of the original decree. It stood permanently. But you could write another decree that would sort of counteract what the first decree said. And that's what he ends up giving them the authority to do. Now, when did this happen? And by the way, they still had a lot of time to do this, thankfully, because of the lot. Because of the lot that had been cast that landed in the month of Adar, in the 12th month. I'd like you to hold your place here for a second. Look at Proverbs. Real quickly, Proverbs chapter 16. It's a very encouraging verse. Proverbs chapter 16. It just is talking about in things that people think there's things of chance, and they're not always chance. Proverbs 16, verse 33. The lot is cast into the lap, but its every decision is from the Lord. Because God can control how it turns out, what comes up. And he certainly did in this case. Back to Esther here. Notice this in verse 9. When did she go back to the king and have this scepter held out to her again? And it's interesting because it says in verse 9, it says, so the king's scribes were called at that time in the third month, which is the month of Sivan, on the 23rd day it was written. So that's when they actually wrote it. They actually wrote this in the third month, the month of Sivan, which tells me it must have happened a little bit shortly before this. Well, brethren, a little bit shortly before this is the time of Pentecost, which I find very interesting. Now, it doesn't necessarily say it's right on the day of Pentecost, but it could be right around Pentecost, or it could have been on the day of Pentecost when she goes back to the king. How this ties in, again, with these days. So, surely, you know, there's a parallel in that. Well, as I mentioned, the name of God, Yahweh in that sense, or God, does not directly occur in this book. But there are four acrostic appearances of the word Yahweh, of the YHWH, where if you look at a sentence that somebody speaks, each word, the words begin, one word was Y, then H, then W, then H. And these occur in Esther 1:20, where a Gentile, Memucan, says something that lines up that way. Then also Esther in Esther 5:4, which is sort of a pivot point of the book. If you look at Esther 5:4, it's an interesting one. It says, "So Esther answered, 'If it please the king, let the king and Haman come today to the banquet I prepared for him.'" Where it says, "Let the king and Haman come," that is YHWH. So and so it's interesting. Another one is where Haman actually speaks in Esther 5:13, and it's in reverse order. By the way, where the Gentiles speak, it's in reverse order. Where Esther speaks, it's in forward order, YHWH. And then in Esther 7:7, where the author of the book speaks, it's there again in forward order, again YHWH. Is that significant? This does not seem to occur like this in any other book. So it may be very significant that it's like this. Who knows? But certainly it's of interest. And then we have, of course, the events in chapter 9. And that tells us about the institution of Purim. And in chapter 9, we are told, we can read here in verses 16 through 22. It says, well, actually, let me mention something else first, because I should have mentioned something about the actual decree, because I want you to notice that. It's where it says, when they wrote this new decree, that I think this is in chapter 8, it says, verse 11, chapter 8, "By letters the king permitted the Jews who were in every city to gather together and protect their lives, to destroy, kill, and annihilate all the forces of any people or province that would assault them, both little children and women, and to plunder their possessions." And everything's, well, that's awful. God's letting the Jews go out and kill all the children. That is not what this is saying. These are the words of the original decree. Notice what it's saying. He says, "To gather together and protect their lives, to destroy, kill, and annihilate all the forces of any people or province that would, quote, quoting the original decree, that would assault them, the Jews, both little children, that is, the Jews' little children, and women, and to plunder their possessions on one day in all the province of the kingdom of Ahasuerus on the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar." That is exact wording of the original decree. So it's just quoting that original decree. And where it's talking about the killing of the children, it's talking about how the original decree, it said the Jews' children could be killed, and that the Jews could defend against that, not that they would go and kill all the children of the enemies. That's what's happening there. And then again, like I mentioned, chapter 9, and I'm going to wrap this up very quickly because I'm out of time. Chapter 9 tells us about the institution of this festival. Because they were able to defeat the enemies on the 13th and the 14th, but they were still fighting in the capital city on the 15th. And so the Jews keep this for 2 days, Purim, lots it means. And they keep this perpetually now. And we see this in verses 26 through 28, it says, "So they called these days Purim, after the name Pur. Therefore, because of all the words of this letter, which they had seen concerning this matter and what had happened to them, the Jews established and imposed it upon themselves and their descendants and all who would join them," which is very interesting, because we know about all the people that joined them who essentially became Jews. And that without fail they should celebrate these 2 days every year according to the written instructions, according to the prescribed times, that these days should be remembered and kept throughout every generation, every family, every province, and every city, that these days of Purim should not fail to be observed among the Jews, and that memory of them should not perish among their descendants. I have a number of lessons that I could go through on this, but I will not. Because there are many lessons that could be drawn from this. But principle on here I think I want us to see is, you know, Romans 8:28, all things work together for good to those who love God, to those who are called according to His purpose. God is working out a plan. He's working out a purpose, and you could see it laid out in what happens in this amazing story. This amazing story where God is not directly mentioned, but He is in there. And we may not see Him directly mentioned in the things that happen in our lives, brethren, but He's in there too. He is running the show from behind the scenes. Let's be grateful for that as we reflect on that this year at Purim.